You're listening to Doing It Right with me, Pandora Sykes, a podcast where I talk to experts about the myths, anxieties, and trends of modern life. In this series, Series 4, I'll be exploring topics including postpartum psychosis, sociopathy, and how technology has flattened personal taste. This is a podcast that asks, what can we do to understand life better? Not just for ourselves, but for everyone. For the first time ever, I'm dropping the whole series in one as a capsule box set. So tuck in and don't forget to let me know your thoughts at doingitrightpod@gmail.com. Effua Hirsch is an award-winning journalist, broadcaster, author and former barrister. She was the co-presenter of a 2020 TV series, Enslaved, with Samuel L. Jackson, and is the author of two books, the Sunday Times bestselling Brit-ish and Decolonizing My Body, a radical exploration of rituals and beauty. I've been really interested in the conversation around beauty and capitalism and colonialism for a while now. Regular listeners to this podcast may remember that I interviewed Jessica DeFino in the last series, and that episode is a really nice compliment to this one. This conversation with Effua was so surprising and thought-provoking. Beauty, it turns out, is the portal for everything. We talk about how Effua learned to reconnect with ancestral practices in Ghanaian culture, like waist beads, why rest is resistance, the origins of hair removal, tattooing as a sacred act, and how globalization and the borderless world has left us yearning for community and rituals. Effua really gets to the heart of this podcast's quest, offering up so many ideas of how to best serve ourselves so that we can better serve others. I hope you enjoy the episode. Effua, thank you so much for coming on to Doing It Right.
Thank you for having me.
Decolonizing My Body came to be when you turned 40 and embarked on a personal and political exploration of beauty, and you called it your year of adornment.
I did.
What did that look like to you?
First of all, it was really a mindset, because whether or not you intend it, there is such a cultural attitude towards turning 40. And I'm actually not someone who tries to, in general, subscribe to those ideas that, you know, I should feel different about myself because of this number. But it's kind of unavoidable. And other people around me turning 40 felt it was a big deal. I found myself having a lot of conversations. And I just don't think there is a way of living in this society and not absorbing negative attitudes about aging, especially for women. It doesn't even have to be your personal value system. It's just osmosis. Everything is telling you it's bad. All of the products that are start to be marketed to you are about trying to stop it or hide it or reverse it. And our whole idea about value and beauty and usefulness all centers younger women in particular. So it would be weird to not feel a certain way about getting older as a woman. And I really didn't intend to have that mindset. So when I found myself picking it up unintentionally, I decided to be really intentional about trying to adopt my own thoughts about my body as I got older. And I wanted to celebrate it. I actually feel great. I've never felt more secure or content or purposeful or loved in my whole life. I love the age that I am. And the messages I was receiving about how I should feel didn't match how I did feel. And I decided to try and reclaim the story by adorning myself. And by that, I mean, I love beauty. I love adornments. I love to dress up. I love to wear jewelry. I love increasingly, and I never used to, maybe we'll talk about that, I love tattoos and I love ways of styling your hair and your body that are forms of self-expression and identity. So I decided to kind of take that to the next level and use that as my device for navigating this different phase of life.
Talk to me about how it was a decolonialist project. So some of the, or all of the Eurocentric beauty standards that you wanted to uncover and divest from, what were some of the ways in which you sought to divest yourself from these colonial ideals?
I think the main thing was actually realizing that I had colonial ideas, because I'm somebody who's been doing a lot of work in my life on understanding systems of race and power, the legacy of empire, you know, it's very much my professional and intellectual and personal project. And I was absolutely astonished, therefore, when I discovered that in my attitudes towards my own body and especially surrounding aging, I did have some really problematic views, and that those do come from a very Eurocentric history of how we think about beauty and value. So it came to a head when I was thinking about tattoos and skin and what happens to a woman's skin as she gets older. And I had a friend who gave birth to twins and had been really tempted to have a tummy tuck because for the first time in her life, she didn't have her six pack anymore. She was very athletic. She had, you know, a very kind of athletic physique. And instead of doing this tummy tuck, she decided to get this tattoo over her abdomen that celebrated a god from her indigenous culture. That's a god of women and of victory. And I just found that so incredible. First of all, her tattoo looked incredible. And I was never a big fan of tattoos, but it was just so beautiful and majestic. And it objectively looked amazing. And I also loved the story that instead of trying to hide this incredible thing she'd achieved by giving birth to twins, and instead of feeling bad about it and trying to have this potentially dangerous operation to mask it, she was instead really embracing it and turning it into something that made her feel good about herself whilst also connecting with her ancestry and heritage. And I think those things aren't a coincidence, because I think when we do connect with stories in our past, they are in themselves a source of strength and power and identity. So that was like a real awakening for me. And it made me question why I had always thought that it was completely socially acceptable to have cosmetic surgery, anti-aging procedures. I mean, I've never thought there was anything wrong with that. But at the same time, lots of the things in my indigenous culture, from my mother's side, my mum comes from Ghana, I was raised to kind of regard as a little backwards, you know, traditional tattooing, scarification, those things always struck me as, you know, something that belonged in the past. And when I really thought about that, I realized those ideas are very colonial. They came from missionaries, literally, who came to countries like the one of my ancestry and said, all of your traditional customs are pagan and savage and backward and primitive. And to be civilized is to become more like a European Christian. And one of the problems with European Christianity is that since the medieval times, it has adopted a really anti-woman, anti-aging woman value system. And we all know the stories about women being burned as witches. And one of the things the church did, and this actually has nothing to do with the religion, but the politics of the church, was decide to frown upon these practices that women in Europe also practiced. You know, they would use tattoos to celebrate rites of passage and aging. In fact, one of the things I learned is that across the world, whether you look at the Arctic or the Amazon, the Middle East or Oceania, all indigenous cultures that I've ever seen included some way that women would celebrate aging, rites of passage, the things they accomplished, the ways they served the community. And that was seen as a source of strength and pride. And it's really quite a modern European colonial project that we have this cult of youth that makes women feel really bad about themselves as they get older. So when I thought about it like that, I thought on the one hand, I could go down this path of feeling really bad about myself and wanting to try and deny the natural things that are happening to my body. Or on the other hand, I could lean into my traditions and almost all of our traditions that really celebrate the accomplishment of still being alive and doing things in the world and in my family. And I choose that. I mean, why would I not? So that was really the turning point that set me on that journey and then made me question what other ideas have I absorbed that are bad for me and take me further away from the ways that women in their wisdom for thousands of years knew how to celebrate who they were in the world.
There's so much to pick up on there. I want to start with, because you have just alluded to that at the end there, with something you call ancestral deficiency syndrome. Talk to me a little bit about what that syndrome is that you identified in yourself and that you suspected lots of other women experienced as well.
Yeah, as somebody of mixed heritage, you know, as I said, my mom's from Ghana, my dad's white, and he has Jewish heritage on his side. I've always felt very aware of my kind of ancestral deficiency because I didn't grow up in either of the cultures of my ancestors. I grew up in Wimbledon. Neither my Jewish antecedents or my Ghanaian ancestors would have recognized the world I was growing up in. And as a result, I felt a kind of illegitimate person to really take up space in either of those cultures. And adding to that a racial dimension where, you know, to be Black in a country like Britain that has a very complicated racialized history and doesn't really admit it was an additional layer of complication. So I felt as a young person, definitely in, you know, into my 20s and even 30s, that I had to fight within myself to connect with my ancestry. But then more recently, I've looked around and realized that this really is not a phenomenon limited to mixed race people growing up in Britain or people of African heritage in the Western world. This is a really global phenomenon that so many of us, one, feel disconnected from our ancestry in ways that bother us, and two, are taking quite radical steps to address that. And, you know, one of the things I looked at was the ways in which DNA services like 23andMe, for example, offer people the opportunity to connect with some story about their ancestry, no matter how remote. So many people I know have done those tests to try and discover where in Africa their formerly enslaved ancestors come from. So many white people I know in America have done it to discover their European immigrant stories. And now companies like Airbnb offer holidays with 23andMe, so you can go to the place where you've discovered your DNA comes from and have some kind of restorative reconnection vacation experience. And these things are really widespread. I mean, everywhere I go, I encounter people who are on this journey of trying to find a story that's been lost in their past. And it really connected with another thing I've been following in a kind of more scholarly way about how I think globalization and, you know, these patterns of global capital and migration, the ways in which we live in this borderless world and our goods and products and services come from everywhere and we go everywhere, in a way you would think that's made us feel more like a global family, but the opposite has happened. I think it's alienated people. I think we're designed as a species to want a connection to a community that has a language and a value system that we share and feel part of. And so I honestly think it's a consequence of this globalization that we're getting smaller. We're looking for smaller connections. We want a place with a culture that we can latch onto, that we can feel is where we're from. And I think that's really affecting people on a massive scale, regardless of their specific heritage or ethnicity. And one of the things that I think is baked into that is this sense that in losing our connection to those stories, we've also lost knowledge systems. We've lost wisdom. We've lost customs and traditions that would actually serve us and make life more meaningful and easy to navigate. Because, you know, if you look at our mental health outcomes and levels of anxiety and depression, it's also clear that this incredible growth in global capital has not made us happier. You know, it's created so much anxiety and a sense of being afoot and disconnected. So I think that we've lost a lot. And, you know, whether real or perceived, we feel that we've lost something meaningful from our ancestors. And in a colonial context, it was done by design. You know, European colonialism went around the world telling people that there was only one way of being civilized, and it was to be as close to Western European behavior and ideas as possible. Quite modern Western European, these are like post-Enlightenment ideas. Europe's also a place that has lost many of its older traditions and customs. And many of those traditions and customs were good for women. So this is a very global story. And I think that we're getting to a point for the first time, really, where the formal mechanisms of empire have fallen away. But now the more deeply rooted cultural ideas about the superiority of imperial thinking, now we're able to challenge those too and actually look back at not just at what happened to land and resources, but what happened to ideas, what happened to indigenous knowledge, what happened to traditional medicines and healing and techniques for childbirth and meditation and spiritual ideas about life and death. I really see everywhere that people are really yearning for those lost knowledge systems and in many ways rehabilitating them. And I think you can choose any knowledge system you want, but it often seems that the one that has some connection to your past or your ancestry, or you can tell yourself a story about it having meaning for you, tends to be one that has more significance. And that's definitely the case with me, that I found so much inspiration in the things that my family lost from our ancestry and tradition that I became quite obsessed with finding them out and learning about them and being able to choose them in my life in a way that actually work so well for the contemporary challenges that me and my family are facing now.
I also thought your note about how this is not a nostalgic project is really valuable. You know, you don't want to go back in time, you say. You want to reconnect with your roots and your ancestry. What does that balance of past and present look like to you?
Well, it's a really complicated question, but I have a really simple answer. And the really simple answer is that I always ask myself, does it serve me? And I ask myself that about everything. And that's actually how I came to this book, that I realized, you know, I don't have a grievance against like post-colonial European culture. It's just that I started to notice there were things about it that don't serve me. And as a woman at a particular age, I noticed that more. You know, when you're in your 20s and you feel young and beautiful, it's you don't really notice that the cult of youth is a problem. It's when you start to realize that you are feeling more valuable to society the older you get, and yet society has the opposite view of you, that you start to perceive that dissonance. So when I'm looking back at my cultural and ancestral traditions, I'm really thinking, like, does this serve me? And I say that as somebody who really values the idea of service. You know, I really think we all have a role to play in making our community and our society in this world, especially with the huge existential challenges we face now, in making it better. So I'm always looking for things that serve me on that path. And so you're right. And I think it is important to say, Pandora, this isn't about romanticizing the past. I'm not saying if I could go back 1,000 years and live in my Akan ancestral community, everything would be perfect. The reality is that the world we live in now is almost unrecognizable in so many ways. You know, the expectations we have, the life expectancy we have, the technology we have. And I'm not trying to undo it. I'm just saying we went to an extreme where we discarded everything that came from traditions like that. And I now recognize that there is incredible and infinite wisdom that could serve someone like me in this modern world with the things that I care about and I'm focused on. So I think everyone, and that's obviously a subjective test that everyone can ask. And I, my main mission with this book, it's not to tell people that one idea is better than another, or that as a woman you should or should not remove body hair or get cosmetic surgery. I mean, if I believe anything passionately, it's that women should be left alone to make their own choices about their bodies. But what I am saying is that if you don't know where those ideas come from, you can't make informed choices. So I want us to understand why we make the choices we do so that we can genuinely choose them. And one of the ways I do that is to ask, does this serve me? You know, as an idea that I've embraced, I must remove all body hair, otherwise I don't look attractive. Is that an idea that serves me? Or is it an idea that, as I discovered when I was writing my book, has cost the average woman about £70,000 over the course of her lifetime? And that she may never have chosen, but it's just what we've been conditioned to believe. So that's really the test that I run to think about ancestry and tradition and whether it should play a role in my life today.
At one point you meet Oprah and she tells you that in order to awaken from your metaphysical slumber, that might be your word, not hers, you must be spiritually ripped. What does it mean to be spiritually ripped? Because I loved this idea. Is it a form of non-religious resilience?
I like that framing of non-religious resilience. I don't think it's that prescriptive. I think that the way Oprah communicated it to me, and it was a very surreal experience that I recount in the book. Yeah, she was advocating this idea of becoming spiritually ripped, and it wasn't a specific, and people often say, like, what's the formula so that I can become spiritually ripped like Oprah thinks I should? But it's never that easy with spiritual growth, is it? There's never a formula. If there was, they would kind of defeat the point, because the whole point is a journey that you go on and you discover who you are and what the point of you is, and you kind of make peace with things that are difficult to make peace with. So it wasn't a specific ritual or idea system or religion. It was more an intentionality. And, you know, that might sound very basic, but for me, I didn't grow up in a religious context at all. I'm very focused on social justice and equality. I have these values that, you know, have a spiritual dimension, but I didn't really have an intentionality to incorporate spiritual practice into my life specifically. I just wanted to be a good person and, you know, not be unwell or exhausted or unhappy. But I didn't really understand the idea of building myself spiritually for the sake of building myself spiritually. And when I had that conversation with Oprah, I looked at my life and my intellectual life and my financial life and my social life and my physical life, all those things I pay attention to. You know, I go to the gym, I care about my friendships, I try as hard as I can to be economically literate. That's, you know, always a work in progress. I read a lot, I do a lot of cerebral work, but I really had neglected my spiritual growth. I hadn't paid the same amount of attention to building myself in that way and gaining that resilience. So I think whatever that looks like for you, it's more about taking seriously that it's a crucial pillar to everything else you do. And also the question that I asked her was basically about how can I hope in a world where I'm intervening in news and climate destruction and racism and class inequality and things that are really just so painful and difficult and never really seem to get better. And I start to feel very drained. And she said, you know, that question is all wrong. You need to be building yourself up to a place of abundance where it comes easily to do the work that you do. And if you're feeling drained, the premise is wrong. I can already tell that you're not going to be able to have a fulfilled life and achieve your potential for making a difference in those things. And that really resonated for me because I was, I think, like so many of us, just kind of like propelled into this world and onto this career path. And I was working really hard and doing my best, but there was an absence of intentionality about it. I was just kind of following the momentum that you follow and the pressures that you're under. So that forced me to take a step back and start to have a lot more agency over the way I plan my journey and be very strategic about how I use my time and ideas.
I'm not in that place of kind of spiritual abundance, and it's really nice to hear, quite aside from the book and your thoughts around the body, like that's just I think a lovely thing for any woman to hear who doesn't feel like they're remotely close to that. It's galvanizing and hope, it makes me hopeful.
Thank you for saying that. I'm really happy to hear that. And one of the responses to the book has been, for me, so fascinating. Women of all ages. I mean, I've had some like much older women really relate to this and say,
I love that.
I assumed that by the time I got to 70, I would have this all worked out. And I'm still totally struggling to work it out. And that for me was so interesting because I think we do assume that time will just solve it. You know, like by the time you get to 40, you're a proper grown up. You've got this. You're exactly the same person you were at 39 and probably as you were at 37. And you still will be at 50. And unless you take matters into your own hands and do this thinking and do this work, and you can also do it at a much younger age as well.
To pick up on how some of the older ladies had said to you, you know, I'm still figuring it out, which is, to be fair, part of like the eternal struggle of life, right? If you had it all figured out, all that's left is to die. But you talk about, and I found this really fascinating, when you're sort of talking about what pre-colonialist life in a lot of African countries was like, and you're looking at how gender was not the organizing principle before colonialism. It was age, and in Ghanaian culture, age is valued over youth, you said, which is obviously so diametrically opposed to how it is in Western life, where kind of the younger that you've become a billionaire, the better. What are some ways in which you have learned about how age is valued, and what can you share that has changed your outlook and sort of enabled you to embrace both yourself as you get older and other people?
I mean, in Ghana, where my mum's family's from, it's still very much the case, and this is, I think, the case in a lot of Africa, that you're still valued the older you are. And, you know, you're kind of a nobody when you're young in an African society, and then you become more important and more revered and more centered with age. And I absolutely love to see it. You know, the older people in my family are treated like royalty when they get to a certain age. And people will travel to come and see you. If they're nearby, they'll come and pay, you know, deference to you. It's understood that it's younger people's job to look after you, to make sure that you are living in a kind of like fitting dignity and luxury for the age that you are. And I would say that it's a kind of prevalent thing in much of human history, because to survive was for a long time such an accomplishment, and because the survival of the group depends upon the knowledge and wisdom of the most experienced people, and experience comes with age. So I honestly think it's a symptom of modern post-industrial and also capitalist society. Because the thing about capitalism, and this affects us in so many ways, and I've written about a few of them in the book, is our value to society often gets reduced to our economic productivity. I mean, literally, we measure the economy based on productivity, which is another way of saying, like, how much labor do individual people contribute? And that, I think that's like an economic statistical phenomenon, but it actually speaks to something deeper and very psychological, which is this idea that your value is your productivity. It's your contribution to the economy. How much money do you make? How much do you serve the growth of GDP? And another way that's affected me is ideas about rest as well, which I write about in the book, because just this idea that your value is your you grinding, you working, you being productive. Now, if you adopt that mindset, then of course an older person is kind of redundant, right? Especially if they're no longer in a job that contributes to GDP. And it's also a mindset that prevents you from seeing the value that people contribute to society that's non-pecuniary, that's not economic. So the wisdom and knowledge, the memory, the oral history, the role in playing, you know, creating cohesion in families and community, all those things that people do more with age, the identity that they're able to offer, the continuity, that, you know, the sense of self they give to younger people, all of these things have no, we don't even have names for them. You can even see I'm struggling with the English language to articulate them. We don't even have the vocabulary for it because we just don't value it in this society that we have now.
One of the colonialist capitalist things that you mentioned earlier that you were seeking to break up with is that idea, or even just seeking to challenge, is that idea of constant productivity, that you always have to be doing rather than resting. And I was fascinated by the contrast between you and your partner, Sam. I'm very much in your camp. You sort of never stop on principle. It sort of feels terrifying to stop. Whereas he deliberately, intentionally, purposefully, yes, use all the synonyms, stops every day, you say. He has organized his life around napping. And I found this completely fascinating. And you mentioned Tricia Hershey's book on how rest is resistance. And I'm fascinated by this in two ways. Firstly, is it really possible, / how does Sam do it, to bring napping into every single day if you have a full-time job and care obligations like kids or elderly parents? And secondly, could you explain a little bit about how rest is radical?
Yes, I love this subject. It's totally changed my life, I have to say. I think many of us, by design, think that to be successful and productive is to just work as hard as you can, as much of the time as you can. And it might be changing now, and maybe post-COVID even more. But when I was younger, you would brag about how little sleep you had and how much you were working. I mean, it was kind of a metric of success, like you are living that life. I think as well, you know, as someone descended from immigrants, there's an additional thing that you've got to just strive until you make it. You've got to grind. You're trying so hard to create a better future for future generations, you know, that they don't have to go through what you did. And the problem with that is that you are unwittingly also, you are creating opportunity. I mean, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the grinding of women in my immediate family who worked so hard and gave me so much opportunity. But along with that opportunity, I also inherited that mindset that I should also now grind. And it's intergenerational. And the reason it's radical not to do that is because it requires, it doesn't sound very radical to like curl up and have a nap, obviously. But ideologically, it's basically a rejection of all of that conditioning that value is success, like value and success are working as hard as possible, creating as much contribution to GDP as possible, accumulating as much wealth and capital as possible. It's a rejection of that. And whatever you do with that rejection, even if you choose to take it up again, at least you're thinking for yourself. You're not just on autopilot from the programming you've had. And that programming often does lead to health and mental health problems, as we know. So just breaking with that, seeing it and deciding to choose your own way of measuring your life and how successful it is, that's radical. But the reason that lying down and having a nap is radical is that it allows you, there's this idea that sleep is a portal to imagination, that you cannot dream, literally. You cannot imagine a different future. You can't create if you are not spending time in quiet and rest and silence. That's where regeneration happens. That's where growth happens. That's where opportunities to see things differently and imagine a different future happen. I, by the way, the thing I love about Trisha Hersey is she doesn't come from privilege. She actually discovered the radical power of rest while she was a single mother doing a PhD coming from a low-income background, living in a low-income community. And she started doing these NAP ministries in her community. And one of the things she's fighting against is this idea that kind of rest and rejuvenation is a luxury for the rich who can go to five-star hotels and spas and have facials and sound baths. That, not that there's anything wrong with that. And listen, I love a retreat at a nice hotel with a spa and a sound bath. But the problem with that is that it's not what rest is as a radical act. That's a lifestyle thing that's nice to have, but lots of people can't afford and don't have a life that can accommodate. But she was really showing how rest can be a community activity, that you can work together to create opportunities for each other as part of something you all believe in, being a community, having a cause, being on a social mission, wanting a better future, that it's something that we can actually do together and support each other in. And then on a deeper level, I think if you understand the power of that, you start to arrange your life differently. I mean, for me, it certainly meant that things I would have said yes to, because I can just add it on top of all the things I'm already doing. Now I understand what it's going to cost me. It's going to cost me my opportunity to have that relationship with my rest and my imagination and my creativity.
The book is split into certain themes, so blood, skin, hair. In the skin chapter, I really love how you talk about getting your hand tattoo, where you've mentioned earlier looking at the kind of ancestral practice of tattoo and scarification in lots of different cultures. And something else that you look at is body hair. And as you begin your year of adornment, you're undergoing this very expensive and lengthy procedure to remove all of your body hair via laser. And this bit you write made me laugh. As atoms are excited, electrons rise and fall, and light beams are making their way into my crack, I wonder why I hate my hairs enough to obliterate them with such sophisticated levels of scientific violence. And the reason why I love this chapter so much is the history that you go into. So Krau from modern day Thailand, whose body was covered in thick, dark hair, and her story is really shocking. And then there's Juliana Pastrana, and both stories and how they were kind of exhibited like they were in a freak show reminded me a little bit of Sarah Bartman, who was also known as the Hottentot Venus. Can you tell me a little bit about how you kind of pulled together those historic stories with also these really lovely modern stories you have, like your friend in Accra who got married and had this amazing detail in her wedding dress to enhance her chest hair?
That was a real awakening for me. That was a wedding I went to, I think, in my late teens, early 20s. And this bride had her, as you said, her wedding dress specifically tailored so that it showed off this feature of her natural chest hair. And I had never occurred to me that that would be something that a woman would be proud of, so proud of it that she would want to showcase it on her wedding day. I always thought that was, if there was any type of body hair to remove, it would definitely, you know, the top of the list of priorities would be chest hair, chin hair, you know, places where women aren't expected to have hair in our culture, let alone then like all the places where everyone knows we do have hair but still remove, like leg hair and underarm hair. It just awoke me to the possibility of a different cultural mindset, because I think, like many of us, I thought these things were kind of objective and universal, but it's a universal fact that it just looks more attractive if you're not hairy as a woman. I did think that. And I began to really see that it's a very culturally specific idea that has just been spread universally. Really, the origins of our modern attitude to body hair come from the industrialization of meat. That when people started living in more concentrated urban areas and salaries began to rise in the Industrial Revolution, and there was this demand for meat, that abattoirs worked out how to mechanize slaughter. And that in doing so, they began to need to strip the hairs from animal carcasses in industrial quantities. And some bright spark who invented a chemical, very toxic chemical combination that could do that, realized that the same thing could be used on human skin and could rid women of this unfeminine body hair. And the desirability of that has its own origins, really, in Darwin's work and the reaction to Darwinian theory about people originating from apes and their horror at this idea that, you know, these civilized Europeans could have once being connected to the animal kingdom, and people wanted to really begin to distinguish and differentiate themselves from lesser species, from primitive species. And this obviously, you know, in the 19th century has very charged racial connotations as well, because they believed that there was this hierarchy of humanity, you know, with white people at the top and, you know, people from other races closer to the primitive animal parts.
And that's what Juliana is used as an example of, isn't she?
Exactly. So Juliana Pastrana and Crowe, both women who didn't meet these ideas about the civilizational potential of hair-free women, you know, they had genetic conditions that actually meant they had an unusually large amount of body hair covering their whole body. And so they were displayed in freak shows. And it, both of their stories are really, really sad. Crowe was kind of captured as a small child, taken away from her family and displayed in this way. She actually, you know, there's a story, I think, that's designed to make us feel better, that she ended up with more agency and she actually displayed herself and made good money out of it and she chose it. But when she died, she had it in her will that she did not want an open casket. She did not want people to gawk at her in death as they had in life. So I really felt that countered this happy story that she so loved people staring at her. And Juliana, her husband, who was her manager, just so ruthlessly exploited her. And when she died giving birth to their child together, he then displayed both her and the child, their dead bodies, to make more money from people being able to look at their unusual body hair. So it really sounds like somebody who was not primarily motivated by love to be able to do that to your dead wife and child. And, you know, both the fact that the people close to them were willing to sell their appearance in that way, and the fact that there were such huge audiences for it, and they were marketed as this missing link. And the missing link is a reference to Darwin, this idea that we've evolved so far from the animal kingdom, but those are our roots, and that these women were the missing link that proved that we were once apes and proved that we were once primates, because they looked so much like them, and that they were a kind of historical kind of blip in the matrix, so you could go straight back to what we used to be. So it was just really, really insulting and very demeaning. And one of the things that's happened as a result of colonialism is that there are just so many tens, hundreds of thousands of people who were denied that cultural right to die properly. I mean, I made a documentary series a few years ago about the transatlantic slave trade, which was about how many bodies of Africans litter the Atlantic Ocean bed, because so many people died during the Middle Passage, during, you know, hundreds of years of enslavement, and were thrown overboard, some mutiny trying to fight enslavement, whole insurrections on ships. The Atlantic is like a graveyard for Africans, and Africans above all believe that dying properly, being buried properly, having the proper rites of funeral passage are so important, that it was really heartbreaking to see so many examples of people who never had that. And, you know, these women whose bodies are still in museums and still exhibited or stored somewhere, having been gawped at and objectified during their life, I just find that really heartbreaking, because it feels like they still have no peace. And in a way, we're still complicit in that.
You speak in the blood chapter, you speak about how when you got your period in the UK, it was, and I had exactly the same thing, it was, you were kind of quite embarrassed or ashamed. You didn't really tell anyone. You certainly didn't talk about it. It was never something we spoke about growing up. And I'm actually so thrilled to see how that's changing now. I'll see teenage girls quite openly saying, oh, does anyone have a tampon, or can I borrow a pad, or I'm going to buy pads, you know, and they'll say it in front of their fathers. And this actually feels quite radical for me growing up in the 90s and early noughties. Anyway, in the blood chapter, one of the ways in which you look at kind of reclaiming some of those rites of passage is you go to these, you go to a puberty ritual, and you explore waist beads, which are a part of Ghanaian culture, but not something that you had ever worn. And when you talk about that with your mum, she says, oh, that's kind of thought of, you know, something that was done in the villages. It wasn't really something that you would do as a modern woman. Can you talk a little bit about waist beads? So their function in Ghanaian culture around menstruation and fertility, and how you discovered, it's not even rediscovered really, is it? Because that was something your mother had kind of intentionally left behind.
Yeah, my family, I would say, were quite early and enthusiastic adopters of colonial ideas. I trace my family history back to about 1750, and They were kind of Christianized quite early. They participated in the colonial system. I mean, like so many people in colonial societies, and empires never in history have worked without being able to co-opt the colonized into the colonial structure and, you know, into kind of finding opportunity within that. So my family, you know, centuries ago began discarding some of their ancestral practices in exchange for more European and Christian ideas. And one of those was this wearing of waist beads, which is actually still very common in many African countries, including Ghana. But waist beads have always fascinated me because they're such an interesting combination of spiritual and practical. So lots of girls wear waist beads, and it's seen on a cosmetic level as a way of celebrating the female form. You know, the ideal of a small waist and like big hips and a very curvy body. Thinness is not ideal at all in most African countries. And so it's partly just a way, and this isn't for show. This isn't for other people to admire. It's a personal adornment to kind of feel your own femininity, to kind of accentuate and be cognizant of your shape and your form. And in a society that really values femininity and also values fertility, which leads me to other practical functions of waist beads. So they operated as like a belt from which you could suspend sanitary products. They helped you notice fluctuations in your weight and early signs of pregnancy. So, you know, they kind of alert you to what's going on in that part of your body. And this is in a society that has no stigma, by the way, around weight gain or those changes. So it's not so that you can notice that you've gained some weight so that you can go on a massive diet. It's just to be aware of what's happening with your body. And for girls in societies like the Akan, which is my ethnic group in Ghana, that also have these rites of passage where when you start puberty and you go through this initiation into womanhood and you're really inducted into this circle of women who welcome you and school you and see it as their responsibility to initiate you and help you grow into that role. And that is something that we've really lost in society. And that also serves spiritual and practical functions. And I really felt so strongly about the loss of that when my daughter started her period, I did an initiation for her. And it was kind of what I wished I'd had. And it was so powerful because my mum and my sister came. And I think even my mum felt maybe she wished that was something she had. And that's the thing about these traditions, that we don't necessarily discard them intentionally. They fall away when we're persuaded that there's something better or superior that we do. And I don't know if any woman in my family ever said, like, I don't want to do this anymore. I think that European ideas are much better. It's just what happens. It's just the influence and the culture that you're exposed to. And also that there are rewards in colonial times for, you know, eating with European cutlery, eating European foods, wearing European clothes, going to European churches. That was the only way you could get jobs in a colonial administration. Your children could go to schools that offer better economic opportunities. Once you're in that system, then you kind of have to make the best of it and find the opportunities within it. So my family discarded all of those traditions, those puberty initiations, the wearing of waist beads. But it was funny when I talked to my grandmother, who's in her mid-90s and so knowledgeable about these things, and obviously she's lived a long time. I thought, and my mum had told me, that there were no traditions like that alive in my family anymore. But when I asked my grandmother about it, she told me that when she started her period, her mother gave her a boiled egg and said, there used to be a whole ritual around this and a whole puberty and initiation thing, but all that had remained by the time she went through puberty was this
was the egg,
boiling of an egg. But she remembered that. And I was like, it wasn't completely gone. By the time my mum came along, I think the egg had disappeared and I'd never even heard of it. So, you know, even the last remaining remnants of a culture can disappear in a generation, right? And that's been a really powerful and restorative experience for me to have these conversations with my mum and my sister and my grandma and discover what they know and they remember and how they feel about these ideas. And it was funny when I talked to my mum about waist beads, she said, oh, they used to do that, you know, hundreds of years ago in the village. And I was like, no, mum, lots of my friends in Ghana still wear them. She was completely shocked. Again, like, I believe in choice. I'm not saying you need to go and wear waist beads, otherwise you don't value yourself as a woman and you don't celebrate your body. And, you know, everyone should do whatever they like. One of the things in this book is that it can be really small things, taking a nap, wearing waist beads, discovering like a tattoo that ancestors in your family would have had and getting it, like, really transformed how I feel about myself.
That's such a lovely note to end on. Wearing waist beads, having a nap and getting a tattoo. Words to live by. Thank you. Thank you so much, Evra.
Thank you, Pandora.
Thank you for listening to Doing It Right. Don't forget, the whole of Series 4 is available to binge now. If you liked the show, please do give it a rating or a review on iTunes. And if you want to chat more about any of the episodes, you can email me at doingitrightpod@gmail.com. Doing It Right is presented by me, Pandora Sykes, with sound by Kelsey Bennett, and production by Pandora Sykes and Kelsey Bennett.